Black Holes and Baby Universes. Hitchcock lecture given at the University of California, Berkeley in April 1988. Falling into a black hole has become one of the horrors of science fiction. In fact, black holes can now be said to be really matters of science fact rather than science fiction. As I shall describe, there are good reasons for predicting that black holes should exist, and the observational evidence points strongly to the presence of a number of black holes in our own galaxy and more in other galaxies. Of course, where the science fiction writers really go to town is on what happens if you do fall into a black hole. A common suggestion is that if the black hole is rotating, you can fall through a little hole in space-time and out into another region of the universe. This obviously raises great possibilities for space travel. Indeed, we will need something like this if travel to other stars, let alone to other galaxies, is to be a practical proposition in the future. Otherwise, the fact that nothing can travel faster than light means that the round trip to the nearest star would take at least 8 years. So much for a weekend break on Alpha Centauri. On the other hand, if one could pass through a black hole, one might re-emerge anywhere in the universe. Quite how to choose your destination is not clear. You might set out for a holiday in Virgo and end up in the Crab Nebula. I'm sorry to disappoint prospective galactic tourists, but this scenario doesn't work. If you jump into a black hole, you will get torn apart and crushed out of existence. However, there is a sense in which the particles that make up your body will carry on into another universe. I don't know if that would be much consolation to someone being made into spaghetti in a black hole to know that his particles might survive. Despite the slightly flippant tone I've adopted, this essay is based on hard science. Most of what I say here is now agreed upon by other scientists working in this field, though this acceptance has come only fairly recently. The last part of the essay, however, is based on very recent work, on which there is as yet no general consensus. But this work is arousing great interest and excitement. Although the concept of what we now call a black hole goes back more than 200 years, the name black hole was introduced only in 1967 by the American physicist John Wheeler. It was a stroke of genius. The name ensured that black holes entered the mythology of science fiction. It also stimulated scientific research by providing a definite name for something that previously had not had a satisfactory title. The importance in science of a good name should not be underestimated. As far as I know, the first person to discuss black holes was a Cambridge man called John Mitchell, who wrote a paper about them in 1783. His idea was this. Suppose you fire a cannonball vertically upward from the surface of the Earth. As it goes up, it'll be slowed down by the effect of gravity. Eventually, it will stop going up and will fall back to Earth. If it started with more than a certain critical speed, however, it would never stop rising and fall back, but would continue to move away. This critical speed is called the escape velocity. It's about 7 miles a second for the Earth and about 100 miles a second for the Sun. Both of these velocities are greater than the speed of a real cannonball, but they're much smaller than the velocity of light, which is 186,000 miles a second. This means that gravity doesn't have much effect on light. Light can escape without difficulty from the Earth or the Sun. However, Mitchell reasoned that it would be possible to have a star that was sufficiently massive and sufficiently small in size that its escape velocity would be greater than the velocity of light. We would not be able to see such a star because light from its surface would not reach us. It would be dragged back by the star's gravitational field. However, we might be able to detect the presence of the star by the effect that its gravitational field would have on nearby matter. It's not really consistent to treat light like cannonballs. According to an experiment carried out in 1897, light always travels at the same constant velocity. How, then, can gravity slow down light? A consistent theory of how gravity affects light didn't come until 1915, when Einstein formulated the general theory of relativity. Even so, the implications of this theory for old stars and other massive bodies were not generally realized until the 1960s. According to general relativity, space and time together can be regarded as forming a four-dimensional space called space-time. This space is not flat. It's distorted or curved by the matter and energy in it. We observe this curvature in the bending of the light or radio waves that travel near the sun on their way to us. In the case of light passing near the sun, the bending is very small. However, if the sun were to shrink until it was only a few miles across, the bending would be so great that light leaving the sun would not get away but would be dragged back by the sun's gravitational field. According to the theory of relativity, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. So there will be a region from which it would be impossible for anything to escape. This region is called a black hole. Its boundary is called the event horizon. It's formed by the light that just fails to get away from the black hole but stays hovering on the edge. It might sound ridiculous to suggest that the sun could shrink to being only a few miles across. One might think that matter could not be compressed that far. But it turns out that it can. The sun is the size it is because it's so hot. It is burning hydrogen into helium like a controlled H-bomb. The heat released in this process generates a pressure that enables the sun to resist the attraction of its own gravity, which is trying to make it smaller. Eventually, however, the sun will run out of nuclear fuel. This will not happen for about another 5 billion years, so there's no great rush to book your flight to another star. However, stars more massive than the sun will burn up their fuel much more rapidly. When they finish their fuel, they'll start to lose heat and contract. If they're less than about twice the mass of the sun, they will eventually stop contracting and will settle down to a stable state. One such state is called a white dwarf. These have radii of a few thousand miles and densities of hundreds of tons per cubic inch. Another such state is a neutron star. These have a radius of about 10 miles and densities of millions of tons per cubic inch. We observe large numbers of white dwarfs in our immediate neighborhood in the galaxy. Neutron stars, however, were not observed until 1967, when Jocelyn Bell and Anthony Huish at Cambridge discovered objects called pulsars that were emitting regular pulses of radio waves. At first, they wondered whether they had made contact with an alien civilization. Indeed, I remember that the seminar room in which they announced their discovery was decorated with figures of little green men. In the end, however, they and everyone else came to the less romantic conclusion that these objects were rotating neutron stars. This was bad news for writers of space westerns, but good news for the small number of us who believed in black holes at that time. If stars could shrink to as small as 10 or 20 miles across to become neutron stars, one might expect that other stars could shrink even further to become black holes. A star with a mass more than about twice that of the Sun cannot settle down as a white dwarf or neutron star. In some cases, the star may explode and throw off enough matter to bring its mass below the limit, but this won't happen in all cases. Some stars will become so small that their gravitational fields will bend light to that point that it comes back toward the star. No further light or anything else will be able to escape. The stars will have become black holes. The laws of physics are time-symmetric. So if there are objects called black holes into which things can fall but not get out, there ought to be other objects that things can come out of but not fall into. One could call these white holes. One might speculate that one could jump into a black hole in one place and come out of a white hole in another. This would be the ideal method of long-distance space travel mentioned earlier. All you would need would be to find a nearby black hole. At first, this form of space travel seemed possible. There are solutions of Einstein's general theory of relativity in which it is possible to fall into a black hole and come out of a white hole. Later work, however, shows that these solutions are all very unstable. The slightest disturbance, such as the presence of a spaceship, would destroy the wormhole or passage leading from the black hole to the white hole. The spaceship would be torn apart by infinitely strong forces. It would be like going over Niagara in a barrel. After that, it seemed hopeless. Black holes might be useful for getting rid of garbage, or even some of one's friends, but they were a country from which no traveller returns. Everything I've been saying so far, however, has been based on calculations using Einstein's general theory of relativity. This theory is in excellent agreement with all the observations we've made. But we know it cannot be quite right because it doesn't incorporate the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics. The uncertainty principle says that particles cannot have both a well-defined position and a well-defined velocity. The more precisely you measure the position of a particle, the less precisely you can measure its velocity, and vice versa. In 1973, I started investigating what difference the uncertainty principle would make to black holes. To my great surprise, and that of everyone else, I found that it meant that black holes are not completely black. They would be sending out radiation and particles at a steady rate. My results were received with general disbelief when I announced them at a conference near Oxford. The chairman of the session said they were nonsense, and he wrote a paper saying so. However, when other people repeated my calculation, they found the same effect. So in the end, even the chairman agreed I was right. How can radiation escape from the gravitational field of a black hole? There are a number of ways one can understand how. Although they seem very different, they are really all equivalent. One way is to realize that the uncertainty principle allows particles to travel faster than light for a short distance. This enables particles and radiation to get out through the event horizon and escape from the black hole. Thus, it is possible for things to get out of a black hole. What comes out of a black hole, however, will be different from what fell in. Only the energy will be the same. As a black hole gives off particles and radiation, it will lose mass. This will cause the black hole to get smaller and to send out particles more rapidly. Eventually, it will get down to zero mass and will disappear completely. What will happen then to the objects, including possible spaceships, that have fallen into the black hole? According to some recent work of mine, the answer is that they will go off into a little baby universe of their own. A small, self-contained universe branches off from our region of the universe. This baby universe may join on again to our region of space-time. If it does, it would appear to us to be another black hole that formed and then evaporated. Particles that fell into one black hole would appear as particles emitted by the other black hole, and vice versa. This sounds just like what is required to allow space travel through black holes. You just steer your spaceship into a suitable black hole. It had better be a pretty big one, though, or the gravitational forces will tear you into spaghetti before you get inside. You would then hope to reappear out of some other hole, though you wouldn't be able to choose where. However, there's a snag in this intergalactic transportation scheme. The baby universes that take the particles that fell into the hole occur in what is called imaginary time. In real time, an astronaut who fell into a black hole would come to a sticky end. He would be torn apart by the difference between the gravitational force on his head and his feet. Even the particles that made up his body would not survive. Their histories, in real time, would come to an end at a singularity. But the histories of the particles in imaginary time would continue. They would pass into the baby universe and would re-emerge as the particles emitted by another black hole. Thus, in a sense, the astronaut would be transported to another region of the universe. However, the particles that emerged would not look much like the astronaut, nor might it be much consolation to him, as he ran into the singularity in real time, to know that his particles will survive in imaginary time. The motto for anyone who falls into a black hole must be, "Think imaginary." What determines where the particles re-emerge? The number of particles in the baby universe will be equal to the number of particles that have fallen into the black hole, plus the number of particles that the black hole emits during its evaporation. This means that the particles that fall into one black hole will come out of another hole of about the same mass. Thus, one might try to select where the particles would come out by creating a black hole of the same mass as that into which the particles went down. However, the black hole would be equally likely to give off any other set of particles with the same total energy. Even if the black hole did emit the right kinds of particles, one could not tell if they were actually the same particles that had gone down the other hole. Particles do not carry identity cards. All particles of a given kind look alike. What all this means is that going through a black hole is unlikely to prove a popular and reliable method of space travel. First of all, you would have to get there by travelling in imaginary time, and not care that your history in real time came to a sticky end. Second, you couldn't really choose your destination. It would be like travelling on some airlines I could name. Although baby universes may not be much use for space travel, they have important implications for our attempt to find a complete, unified theory that would describe everything in the universe. Our present theories contain a number of quantities, like the size of the electric charge on a particle. The values of these quantities cannot be predicted by our theories. Instead, they have to be chosen to agree with observations. Most scientists believe, however, that there is some underlying unified theory that will predict the values of all these quantities. There may well be such an underlying theory. The strongest candidate at the moment is called the heterotic superstring. The idea is that space-time is filled with little loops, like pieces of string. What we think of as elementary particles are really these little loops vibrating in different ways. This theory does not contain any numbers whose values can be adjusted. One would therefore expect that this unified theory should be able to predict all the values of quantities, like the electric charge on a particle, that are left undetermined by our present theories. Even though we have not yet been able to predict any of these quantities from superstring theory, many people believe that we will be able to do so eventually. However, if this picture of baby universes is correct, our ability to predict these quantities will be reduced. This is because we cannot observe how many baby universes exist out there waiting to join on to our region of the universe. There can be baby universes that contain only a few particles. These baby universes are so small that one would not notice them joining on or branching off. By joining on, however, they will alter the apparent values of quantities, such as the electric charge on a particle. Thus, we'll not be able to predict what the apparent values of these quantities will be, because we don't know how many baby universes are waiting out there. There could be a population explosion of baby universes. Unlike the human case, however, there seem to be no limiting factors such as food supply or standing room. Baby universes exist in a realm of their own. It's a bit like asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. For most quantities, baby universes seem to introduce a definite, although fairly small, amount of uncertainty in the predicted values. However, they may provide an explanation of the observed value of one very important quantity, the so-called cosmological constant. This is a term in the equations of general relativity that gives space-time an inbuilt tendency to expand or contract. Einstein originally proposed a very small cosmological constant in the hope of balancing the tendency of matter to make the universe contract. That motivation disappeared when it was discovered that the universe is expanding. But it was not so easy to get rid of the cosmological constant. One might expect the fluctuations that are implied by quantum mechanics to give a cosmological constant that is very large. Yet we can observe how the expansion of the universe is varying with time, and thus determine that the cosmological constant is very small. Up to now, there has been no good explanation for why the observed value should be so small. However, baby universes branching off and joining on will affect the apparent value of the cosmological constant. Because we don't know how many baby universes there are, there will be different possible values for the apparent cosmological constant. A nearly zero value, however, will be by far the most probable. This is fortunate because it is only if the value of the cosmological constant is very small that the universe would be suitable for beings like us. To sum up, it seems that particles can fall into black holes that then evaporate and disappear from our region of the universe. The particles go off into baby universes that branch off from our universe. These baby universes can then join back on somewhere else. They may not be much good for space travel, but their presence means that we will be able to predict less than we expected, even if we do find a complete unified theory. On the other hand, we now may be able to provide explanations for the measured values of some quantities like the cosmological constant. In the last few years, a lot of people have begun working on baby universes. I don't think anyone will make a fortune by patenting them as a method of space travel, but they have become a very exciting area of research.